Well, welcome to the Madison Skeptics, everybody. My name is John, and I am one of the co-founders. The other co-founder in the room is Jennifer, sitting in the back with the green sweatshirt on. Today, we have our speaker is Dr. John Hawks, University of Wisconsin, is it the anthropology department?
Yeah.
Okay. And I'll say a little bit more about him, but then he'll introduce himself, too. And I see we're going to talk about evolution today. It's getting so bored of evolution.
But it's always changing.
It is always changing. So, I started reading Dr. Hawks' blog probably, close to a year ago. And it was just around the time that I started reading that Dr. Hawks got tenure at the UW-Madison. And as part of his, I don't know how you describe it, winning or being awarded or the victory of crossing that threshold
the
and getting
lottery
tenure.
Is what it is.
But he blogged about people in his position, academic researchers, scientists, university professors, who blog, and blogging is a relatively new phenomenon. It's only probably in its heyday for the last maybe 3 or 4 or 5 years. Kind of run that Carl Sagan risk, where Carl Sagan, distinguished scientist, who was also a popularizer of science, actually got criticized by many of his scientific colleagues because they kind of thumbed their nose at this idea of popularizing. And so I saw a little bit of a parallel there with the decision to become a blog author and putting yourself out there in a sort of a popular tech way on the internet. And Dr. Hawks had a lot to say about that, and a lot of your respondees then did too, about the risks of blogging and how there have been some academics who feel that their tenure chances were actually hurt because they were very popular bloggers. So anyway, that's how I came to know him. His blog is on my frequent visited list. I check his out pretty much every day and usually at least a couple of times a week. He's written a lot about many of the, probably all of the recent topics in evolution, especially as it touches on early humans. And as we see today, he's going to talk about why is human evolution accelerating? And I have a hunch that's controversial. And he's going to tell us a little bit more about that. So thank you for coming, Dr. Hawks.
Thanks. Yeah. Okay. Like you said, I'm at the UW. I'm in anthropology. I got my degree in anthro at the University of Michigan in 1999. I was at the University of Utah for several years on a postdoc, and I've been here in Madison for 7 years. I became a geneticist mostly by accident. At least I can't say it was really great design. It was in the 90s, the big news in anthropology, or at least human evolution, as an aspect of anthropology, was modern human origins. And at that time, modern human origins, most of the sort of rapidly developing evidence about this was genetic. And I was working in a traditional anthro program really focused around ancient humans and interpreting fossil evidence and steeped in what you'd call the history of the field. But it was pretty clear that the future of the field was going to be increasingly related to our ability to sequence people's genes. Well, that really has come to fruition. And the kinds of data sources I'm going to talk about today are tremendous compared to anything that we had available 10 years ago. They outweigh, in many respects, one of the most exciting things that's going on right now in human evolution is the Neanderthal genome. We're going to have the complete 3 billion base pair genome of Neanderthals by the end of the year. And if you think about 20,000 genes in the human genome that we'll have copies of in Neanderthals, we'll be able to look at similarities and differences. We have, of Neanderthals, something like 400 fossils, where the fossils are usually a piece of some arm bone or a little piece of a skull. We have maybe a dozen relatively complete Neanderthal crania. We have 3 or 4 skeletons that are complete enough to work with, talk about limb proportions and that sort of thing. So if we start saying we've got 20,000 pieces of evidence about these guys, that outweighs by far anything that we had available to us in the fossil record before. So this is an exciting time to start learning about the past. Oh, this is miserable. I hate these transitions. You guys have all seen this before. This is my favorite version, the one that I have here. Because this, it's Jacques Chirac out in front of here, and this guy's saying, I'm going to stop here because there's a big idiot in front of me. Okay. The stuff that I've been working on lately with recent evolution. When I say recent, what I mean is the last 40,000 years, so after the Neanderthals. I work on Neanderthals also, and I think they're fascinating. But some of this stuff that I've been working on with more recent evolutionary changes has gotten a lot of press lately, and it's sort of fun to talk about because it tells you some things about the ways that we've changed recently. And Superman here has a milk mustache. Many of you know that drinking milk is weird. Humans aren't supposed to do this. I mean, it's like if God meant for us to drink milk, he would have given us lactase persistence. Well, only a few of us have it. Most of us don't. So it's normal for kids to drink milk. It's normal for juvenile mammals of all kinds to drink milk. If they didn't, they'd be dead. But it's normal for this to shut off at around the time that you're weaned. And it's adaptive for it to shut off. If you imagine bulls nosing up under cows to try to get milk, it's something that wouldn't fly in nature. It's weird that humans do this. My friend Greg Cochran calls us mampires. This is a real X-Man sort of thing that some humans have and others don't. My work is not funded by the Wisconsin Dairy Council, but we've got all kinds of milk products in this state and around the world. Some of them subtract the lactose out of milk for you. So cheese is not usually very much lactose left. The mold or the bacteria take it out. Yogurt, similar story. But then there's other stuff, you know, whole milk or some kinds of cheeses and fresh milk products, where the sugar is in there. It gives you discomfort if you eat very much of it and don't have lactase persistence because the bacteria in your gut are happy to eat that for you. And they'll create gas and lactic acid. It's not real pleasant. And so that's why people don't like milk. We call them lactose intolerant. We used to think there was something wrong with them. The government told you that you needed your 4 servings a day. And if you don't drink it, bad things will happen. It's weird.
Is it good for you, though?
Is milk good for you? Yeah. Absolutely. It's got the calcium and everything, the fat and everything that you need.
But what about skim milk?
Skim milk?
Fat-free milk.
Fat-free milk doesn't have the milk, doesn't have the fat in it, still has the lactase in it, still has the calcium in it. So, you know, on balance, it's good for you. But if you're not lactase persistent, then it's not going to be real pleasant. All right. Here's a mosquito. This is Anopheles. It's drinking somebody's blood. As you probably know, malaria and lots of other bad things are carried by mosquitoes, so I'll talk about malaria. Here's what the Plasmodium does to your red blood cells. It's not real pleasant. After it infects your red blood cells, it gets into your liver, sometimes your brain, it's bad. Well, some of us have these strange characteristics that give us some native resistance to malaria. The sickle cell trait is the most famous of these. Here's a sickle cell in a homozygote. If you carry 2 copies of the sickle trait, the sickle allele, you get the sickle trait, and that's bad. Before any kind of medical intervention was invented for this, you were dead before you were a teenager. Nowadays, you can survive with the sickle cell trait up into your 30s and 40s, but it's still not good. Once in a while, you get somebody who's a heterozygote for this who has a problem. Up at the Air Force Academy, once in a while, they have kids who go up and are running, you know, around the base at high altitude, and they collapse. And sometimes it's a sickle cell heterozygote, somebody who carries 1 copy of this, because under those stress conditions, it can make a difference to your blood. But normally, sickle heterozygotes don't have a big problem, and it's highly adaptive against the Plasmodium parasite. All right, this is one of my daughters. Here's one place where the orange wall color doesn't help because her eyes are the same color as this denim hat, blue eyes. Blue eyes are, to the best of our ability to tell, 10,000 years old. Nobody on Earth who lived more than 10,000 years ago had blue eyes. Nobody on Earth who lived more than 3,000 years ago had the sickle cell trait. Nobody on Earth who lived more than 8,000 years ago had lactase persistence. This stuff is all new. When we talk about human evolution, a lot of us are used to thinking about things that are super old. So here's Lucy's skeleton. She's 3.2 million years old. Here's a skull of Lucy's species. This is, you know, these are different kinds of primates from us in the sense that they don't have the kind of stuff that we have. Like us, we'll go back to Lucy, they're bipeds. We know that their pelvis, their legs, to some extent their spines are adapted to upright walking, but otherwise, they're pretty different from us. If we look at their skulls, they're very ape-like. They're ape-like in the size of their brain, they're ape-like in their facial morphology. The thing about them that's not ape-like is their teeth, but they aren't especially human-like either. They had big, thick teeth that were made to grind up heavy foods. Our teeth and chimpanzee teeth are tiny compared to these. So when we think about evolution, we think about things that happened a long time ago. And if we go forward through time, we can trace changes that happen over time. So this is one of the crania from Dimonisi, which is in Georgia. Not our Georgia, the Peach State, but the Soviet Republic of Georgia. And as you can see, they were not the top of the food chain, necessarily. We've got wounds on the bottom of one of these crania from carnivore. They're a little bit bigger in the brain than earlier hominids were. Their faces are a little more vertical than earlier hominids were. If we look at a Neanderthal, which now is something like 50,000 years old, come way up in time, very large brains, faces that are more sort of like ours, but still having a brow ridge and their faces stick forward a lot. They lived hard lives also, and they were mean people. But they lived in beautiful places. I have all these slides in here to talk about the Neanderthal genome, which I don't want to say a lot about, but this bone in particular is really cool. This is a piece of a tibia. It's this little part of a leg. And this bone was stuck in the fauna from this site. This is Vindija Cave in Croatia. It really is that green and beautiful outside of it, and there's strawberries that grow outside. And nowadays, the floor of this cave is about this much lower because they excavated out of it. And among other things, they found Neanderthals. They found this bone, which wasn't recognized as a hominid. You can see why. I mean, it's a piece of a tibia. It's not terribly diagnostic in comparison with the other likely candidates, like deer and elk and so on. It's not. But you have to look at it closely to tell. This bone has produced the purest and best representation of DNA from any Neanderthal age fossil. It's lucky that they threw this in with the fauna, it looks like, because what happened was that after they initially tossed it in there, no other anthropologist handled it. The biggest problem that we have with bones from this age is that the contamination that comes in by modern handling vastly outweighs the actual DNA that's preserved inside the bone. And it's difficult to explain how all this contamination gets in there. I mean, these guys who do this work, they take a bone, which are usually a little better shape than this, and they drill into it and take only the outside part after they've etched the outside of it with acid. So you get rid of all contamination prospects on the outside surface. Etch through this. You get to the inside of it, and then you smash it up under clean room conditions so that no DNA from any of your workers, they're all wearing masks, and there's positive air pressure in the room so the DNA can't come in from outside. They go to incredible lengths. And after they've gone to all this trouble, it's still only 25% endogenous DNA and 75% contamination of some kind. And by contamination, I don't mean like if you do the sequencing from this, do I have a shot of it? No, I don't. If you do the sequencing from this, only a small fraction of it is hominid. A lot of it's fungus. A lot of it's bacteria. their strategy when they do this is to sequence every fragment of DNA. And most of the fragments are from some other kind of organism that's been growing in the bone after it was buried. A lot of it's unidentifiable. You know, some soil organism, and they haven't identified it yet. Only a small fraction of it belongs to a hominid. And of the kind that belongs to a hominid, most of it comes from somebody like me who was studying it in the lab. And you imagine, how did it get contaminated? And I think the anthropologists are, you know, they're behind closed doors. Who knows, you know? It's crazy. It happens that a lot of the contamination they found in the last year or two came from outside the laboratory reagents that they ordered in. They were good enough for forensic work, but not good enough for this, evidently. And you hear stories, like in Germany, this just a couple weeks ago, they found that a bunch of crimes, they thought they had a serial killer, and the serial killer was a woman. It turns out that all of these DNA from all of these cases were contamination on the cotton swabs that had been, you know, some woman in the factory. And the company says, well, we never said that these cotton swabs were suitable for forensic work. You know, they were like using factory, you know, fresh Q-tips instead of something that had been sterilized. So it's crazy how this contamination can happen. Well, if we go forward in time, we've got Cro-Magnons, modern humans, and they don't look like Neanderthals anymore. They look like they've got no big brow ridge. They've got really high and rounded foreheads, like mine. They've got their cheeks are smaller. Their faces are small. The major things that make a modern human is that the brain is not any smaller or bigger. The brain's about the same. But the face is smaller and is tucked underneath the brain. From those two things, almost everything else follows in terms of how we diagnose modern humans as an anatomical set. If we look over the long term of our evolution, this goes from about 2 million years ago up to the present, and the long term trend in human evolution is that the brain gets bigger. And these last bunch here are Neanderthal era. So they've got the biggest brains of all. That's human evolution. That's the story. There it is. When you get up to the end of this time, something like 30,000 years ago, the idea is that you've come up to modern humans who are basically like us. So here's the art from Chauvet Cave in France, 30,000 years old. People who made this art are like us. We have a lot of doubt about the way that earlier people who didn't make these kinds of symbolic expressions, you know, how similar were they to us? Did they talk? Did they have symbolic representations of the world at all? You know, how were their lives different? Those are all really important questions from the standpoint of our evolutionary history. The tendency up until, I guess, the last few years has been to say, once you get to here, the story's over. This is modern humanity. But we've known for a long time that things don't stop changing 30,000 years ago or 40,000 years ago, that there's actually relatively rapid change that's happened after that time. And I got interested in studying these changes from the standpoint of the genetics. Here's the chart again, brain size increasing over time. This is the same chart, except this is confusing because now time is a logarithm and it's going backwards in time this way. Whereas in the previous chart, it's going backwards the other way. Yeah, in this chart, time goes forward as we go right, left to right. In this chart, it goes backwards as we go left to right. But the little end of this, brain size gets up to a maximum, something like 10,000 years ago, and then it goes the other direction. And this is especially clear if we look at this sequence. This is males in Europe from 15,000 years ago to the present. They max out about 10,000 years ago, and then the mean declines. And this is also true in China. Here's early Neolithic Chinese. This is the first farmers in China. And the brain size declines. We've got a lot of variation within recent human populations. Most of this variation did not exist 30,000 years ago. Modern humans originated as one population. When we spread through the world, we were relatively homogeneous at the beginning. The differences that have arisen since that time are differences that have arisen fast in an evolutionary context. They're differences that have arisen as consequences of adaptation. And so when we look through the world at variation, we still have people in the world that have brow ridges. We still have people in the world who have large faces. We still have people in the world who have bigger teeth than anybody who lives in the United States today. We have people in the world who vary. And anthropologists have sort of known this for a long time. So this is a chart from 1944. What we've got here are skulls from Switzerland from sort of late Roman era, 5th to 8th centuries, up to the 19th century. Two samples. What this is measuring here is the cranial index. The cranial index is the ratio of the breadth of the skull divided by its length. This is old-time science. Old-time science. They used to go out with calipers and measure people, and they'd talk about, are you long-headed, are you broad-headed? And the long heads, everybody knows, are better. And the broad heads are worse. And the long heads invaded Europe from the east, and they brought their Indo-European languages with them. We call these the Aryans. And then the broad heads came in from somewhere else. This is all race theories of 1920. We no longer believe any of these things. We don't believe them because they're false. The long heads didn't come in. The broadheads didn't come in from some other place. This wasn't migrations of people. What it was one population of people, maybe under the influence of genetic exchanges, maybe not, evolving from one thing to the other. The Swiss really are different than they were 2,000 years ago. The Scandinavians are different. The Japanese are different. People in South Africa are different. When we look at archaeological skulls from cemeteries, where we have medieval cemeteries, they're really different from the ones of people that live there now. Some of this is a direct consequence of the environment. Some of it is a consequence of genetic change that's happened. With phenotypes like this, it's very difficult to tell those apart. If I had to guess what's going on with the cranial index, as an example, I'd say what's going on is that skulls get smaller. That we know. We know that the pace of them getting smaller, we look at those charts, it's greater than can be explained by body size. Body size hasn't changed. The skulls got smaller. So we'll say that what happened was that people really were evolving to have smaller brains. And that had consequences for the shape of the skull. But that's all speculation with respect to mechanism. The teeth shrank. These are teeth in Europeans over the last 100,000 years. I'm showing you the longer time span here for a couple reasons. One is because these and these are Neanderthals. These are means of samples. This is early modern Europeans. These are people who followed Neanderthals. These are Neolithic people. These are medieval people. What you see is a reduction, and notice that the reduction from the early modern humans to Neolithic people is more than the difference between Neanderthals and early modern people. And as we go further up in time, this sort of happens a little faster. These changes, which are changes for tooth size, presumably under the influence of disease, what we get is these people almost never had cavities, and these people had them a lot. Why are smaller teeth better? Smaller teeth have less surface area. This probably is an adaptation to reduce cavities.
Why not a straightforward response to dietary changes?
It's not clear how that creates the environmental pressure in the sense of a fitness difference. So, you know, why couldn't Neanderthals eat the same food as the rest of us when what they're eating is basically agricultural foods? The cavities are direct are a direct result of the diet difference. Why do they start getting cavities? It's not because their teeth are smaller. It's because they're eating foods that the bacteria eat. And probably they've introduced new bacteria. So those two things. Once you introduce the cavities, then the question is, where do the fitness differences come from? Because this has got to happen under selection. Fitness differences probably are the pathology, as opposed to the bigger teeth are less efficient and the smaller teeth are more efficient. Okay. I started on this topic because of the genes, which for the first time in about almost four years ago, gave us an opportunity to look for really recent evolutionary changes. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about what a gene is. These are chromosomes. We've got 46 of them. If we look at the ones we have, they're numbered 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on. You'll notice on this chart, which is a genetic map, that the chromosomes are numbered in order of their length. 1 is the longest one. 22 is the shortest one. And they were numbered that way because people were plotting out chromosomes in humans according to their length. They wanted to be able to sort them. The other thing that you'll see on this map is these bands, dark and light. These bands originally were made by people who used a chemical to stain the chromosomes. And when you stained them, these bands would strike out. We now know that the bands are there because of the different content in nucleotides at different parts. Some parts are more G and C rich, others are less so. So we get these dark and light bands standing out. The first genetic maps attempted to connect traits that are inherited, initially on fruit flies, but later in people, with these bands. So you could say that fruit flies, you've got a mutation, makes your eyes white instead of red. And the white-eyed flies, they're always inheriting this band in common with each other. So you could say that that gene that makes the eyes red or white is something that occurs on this chromosome. That ultimately was the test of the chromosome theory. They showed that parts of chromosomes were inherited together with traits. These days, we have more detailed genetic maps. So this is chromosome 2. Here you've got those bands. Chromosomes have a short arm, which is P, and a long arm, which we call Q. And they have band numbers. In this case, we're looking at a red spot here, which is at 21.3 on the Q arm. So chromosome 2, Q, 21.3. There it is. The bottom part here is a blown-up version of what's around this, and the blown-up version has a count. And the count here, 136,270,000, is the number of nucleotides from the start. And here, 136,310,000, also the number since the start. So we've got a genome map that's based on the actual physical position of things on chromosomes when we're counting nucleotides from beginning to end. I've picked out this part to show because this gene, LCT, is the lactase gene. This gene is what makes you able to digest milk sugar. If we zoom out, well, let me show you a couple other things. One thing, these blocks are exons. Those are the coding parts of this gene. The big spots in between these are introns. They're subtracted out of the gene sequence. These little lines down here, it says HapMap SNPs, SNPs. These are single nucleotide polymorphisms. I'm going to talk about these a lot. Each of these spots, each of these positions, is a position where some people have one version and other people have a different version. So some people have an A and other people have a T. Or you have two copies, you might have an A and a T, or a T and a T. So these constitute genotypes. Each of these is one that's variable in human populations. There are more that are variable in human populations. This is a subset of them. This subset is present in what's called the International Haplotype Map, or HapMap. The HapMap is version 2.0 of the Human Genome Project. Version 1.0 gave us this sequence where we have the count. Version 2.0 went back and looked at different people to see where they were different. Okay, what I've done here is I've zoomed out. Here we've got lactase. I'm going to zoom out. I'm going to look at a bigger range. I've zoomed out by a factor of about 10. Here's lactase. It's still right in the middle. This arrow is pointing to its neighbor gene, MCM6. MCM6 has nothing whatsoever to do with milk. It's cell membrane something. And the reason why the arrow is pointing to it in this spot in the middle of it is because that is where the mutation happened in Europeans to let them drink milk when they're grown-ups. This is a regulatory mutation. It's a mutation that affects the expression of LCT, which is, in this case, upstream of it. So we've got a regulatory mutation. This points out a couple of things. One is that when we are looking for things that cause effects, we're not always looking in the middle of a gene. We might be looking some distance from the middle of the gene. We might be looking at something that's far away. Another thing is that if I tell you that I've found a candidate for selection, something's changed in a gene, it could very easily be that whatever's changed doesn't have anything to do with the gene. It could be something upstream or downstream of it. It could be something else. In this case, MCM6, we happen to know generally what it does. We know a lot about what LCT does. We know a little bit about what this gene does, but these other genes, we don't know anything about what they do. There's a lot of genes that your guess is as good as mine. Sometimes the computer tells us, based on the inferred amino acid sequence of this gene, we believe it binds to DNA. Or this gene has a high sequence homology. Here's homology with humans, mice, rats, and so on. Has a high sequence homology with this other gene in fruit flies that we know does X. A lot of human genes are like this. We know what 5,000 of them do pretty well. A large set of them, we don't know what they do at all. This is Salt Lake City. I wanted to mention this because this is where the first HapMap sample came from. We talk about Europeans, but actually the Europeans in question initially were Mormons. They're Mormons that came from Europe and settled in Salt Lake City. We also have populations in the initial draft of the HapMap from West Africa. There are Yoruba people from Nigeria, and from East Asia. There's a set of people from China, from Beijing, a set of people from Japan, Tokyo. In version 3 of the HapMap, so 3.0, we've got a number of other populations, and those are the things that I'm studying now. So we've got people from North India, we've got people from Tuscany, we've got people from Kenya, there's a couple of populations with pygmies, there's people from all over the place. One of the things that we can do if we have polymorphisms is we can look for evidence that polymorphism has been changing in frequency lately.
What are polymorphisms?
Polymorphism is a genetic variation. Some people have one thing, other people have another. So single nucleotide polymorphism, SNPs, is an example of a polymorphism. What I'm showing here is a bunch of sequences. Each of these lines is a sequence. And these sequences are mostly identical. But there are some places that I've denoted with circles here where there are differences. Some people have one version, other people have another version. So the differences here are red or blue. For single nucleotide polymorphisms, it's almost always the case that we have one is one, and the other is something else, and there's two different versions. Normally, if we look at copies of sequences from lots of people, we'll see that polymorphisms are sort of scrambled up. Two of them that are real close to each other might tend to be inherited together. So you see this person has two reds, but sometimes they're not. Here's a red and a blue, here's a red and a blue. And if we look very far, we'll see that what you see in this one, blue, red, red, blue, red, red, blue, red, 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 they don't predict each other. They're scrambled, in other words. But if we were to introduce a mutation here, that had some advantage, the effect of this is that it will increase in frequency. So it goes from one copy here up to three copies. And as it does that, if this is happening fairly quickly, it carries with it the stuff that's next to it. So here you can see this is connected to blue, blue, red, red, and it carries with it these blue, blue, red, reds. This is called hitchhiking. So you start out with one thing and it starts becoming common, and it takes with it stuff that's connected to it over a long distance. If this continues to grow, increase in frequency, it'll continue to hitchhike, but once in a while it recombines with something else. And so this thing that was here before stays here. But the stuff that's close to this continues to hitchhike with it. Once you get up to this stage, now the distance across which you have this, what we call in genetic terms, linkage, the distance across which people who carry the same thing have the same genotype going down the genome, this becomes a function of time. The faster this happens, the longer distance things tend to be identical. If this happened very slowly, they would be shuffled up more. So this gives us a way of looking at changes in frequency and the pace at which they've happened. Ultimately, if this mutation goes up to fixation, what happens is that some area of the genome becomes uniform. There's no variation there anymore. Everybody's got the same thing. And in the present day, if we were to look at this part, we would say, gee, everybody looks the same. I guess there's no polymorphisms there for us to study. We can look for regions like this, and there are a number. But they're hard to find compared to regions like this, where you notice that some people are really uniform over a long distance, and other people are really varied. This gives us a really strong signature that something happened. If nothing at all had happened, they'd look like this. Everybody would be shuffled. So, for instance, this is a chart where we're looking at one nucleotide location, one polymorphism right here in the middle, and we're looking at the linkage around it, where everybody who carries two copies of this are plotted in yellow, and everybody who carries two copies of the other version, so we got homozygotes for one allele and homozygotes for the other allele, are plotted in blue. And what you can see is that homozygotes for one of the alleles, if we go down the genome and look at other polymorphisms, they're pretty scrambled through here. But homozygotes who carry the mutant version of this, we would call it, the yellow version, they're uniform as we go a ways away from this. And it's only after we get to some distance that they start to be more mixed. So this pattern, it's a disequilibrium. We're looking at a genotype that has an effect of being linked to a large area of the genome. Here's a couple of examples of genes that are like this. G6PD, this is glucose 6-phosphate deficiency, is what the D is for. And this is something that's really common in Africans today. G6PD deficiency is what we call favism. You've heard of people who are allergic to fava beans. This is what they have. Favism is a malaria defense. It's common in Africa because it makes you resistant to falciparum malaria. It's on the X chromosome, so it happens to be pretty easy for us to look for. And what you can see from this chart is that from the center point of this gene going outwards away from it, the genes are highly linked across this region. So what we're looking at is something that has really changed rapidly in frequency. Our estimate for G6PD deficiency is less than 3,000 years old. That makes a lot of sense because falciparum malaria, which we think it's the resistance factor to, is only about 5,000 years old. So this is coming in as a defense to malaria. DRD4, this is the D4 dopamine receptor. And what it does, dopamine is a neurotransmitter. DRD4 is one of many dopamine receptors. This allele of it, the 7R allele, 7R is for 7 repeats. And The differences between DRD4 alleles is in repeat number. Some of them have 4 or 2 repeats, some of them have 7. The 7 repeat allele is notable, first because in European Americans, it correlates with ADHD. So kids who are diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity, they're more likely to be DRD4 7R. Not 100% likely. This doesn't explain all of ADD, but explains some fraction of it. The other thing that's notable is that they live longer. It looks like 90-year-olds have more 7R than they ought to. It shows some signs that it's been changing in frequency. But unlike G6PD, which is really recent, DRD4 is older. We estimate it's something like 40,000 years ago that this came under selection to start increasing in frequency. Lactase is a really, really good example for us. Because lactase, first of all, our estimate of the origin of this about 8,000 years ago, this is an estimate that comes from the genetics. We look at the linkage around lactase and we say, we estimate it's 8,000 years old. That's the European version. It turns out that there are 5 versions that confer lactase persistence. 3 of them in Africans in different populations, 1 in Arabia. The European one is the most widespread. It's most common in Northern Europe. In Germany, it's about 79%.
So, do we think that it's that people started drinking more milk and therefore our body developed like an acceptance of that? Or is it because our body was accepting of it that we didn't stop?
So, which came first? The mutation or the milk, right?
Right. Or do we not know?
I think we have a pretty good reason for thinking that we know, but let's take a look.
Okay.
So, for instance, in Europe, we've got dairying that comes into you. This mutation, I won't say it happened in Europe. I think it's quite likely it happened in Central Asia. It's most common in Europe now. We'll talk about why that is. We've got people in Europe 7,000 years ago keeping dairy animals. That we know. They come in with a Neolithic. They're using pots to process milk. They're making some milk products, but they're also drinking milk directly. 5,000 years ago, it happens that we have a sample of skeletons that some folks went and did DNA sequencing in to try to find out if they had lactase persistence. So that's what I've got here. 5,000 years ago, they went looking. They found it, looking in 25 skeletons, they found it in none. None of them have it. This is a part of the world that today, this gene is at 80%. 5,000 years ago, it was not there in a frequency that we can observe.
Wait, why do you have a positive amount there then, though?
So why do I have this here? Because if this gene originated 8,000 years ago, one of the things that we can predict is what its pattern of increase over time should be. If it originated 8,000 years ago, the characteristic spread of a new allele under selection is very, very slow at first. This is a logistic growth curve. It happens very slow, and then as it becomes more common, it accelerates in its pace of change, and it comes up to a maximum rate of change when it gets up to about 50%, and then it slows. And it takes a long, long time to fix, and this fixation time depends on whether it's dominant or recessive or additive or what. But what this shows is that if we looked at something now that's very common, but that originated 8,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago, it should have been very rare. And that's precisely what we're seeing in the skeletons. 5,000 years ago, it's rare. 3,000 years ago, there's a sample of skeletons from the Ukraine, which is not as big. There's not as many skeletons there. But they found it in a third of them. 3,000 years ago, that's about what we expect to see. I really love the example because it confirms the theoretical prediction well with the empirical data. But now, to ask the question, what came first, the mutation or the milk? It's evident that these people could have used this. They were drinking the milk. They didn't have the mutation in large numbers. It was probably there rarely. But they didn't have it in large enough numbers to make a difference to the population. What it made a difference to was the few people who carried it. They increased over time because their environment was a milk-using environment. Now we can ask, why is it most common in Northern Europe now? why isn't it most common in Mesopotamia, where they domesticated cattle? It's most common in Europe because, presumably, in Mesopotamia, they had other foods that made up the difference. Whereas in Northern Europe, they didn't have wheat. They couldn't get wheat to go until the last couple hundred years there. They had rye, and they had barley. Not great grain crops. So milk made more of a difference. When we talk about the difference that lactase persistence makes, I talked to a geneticist one time about this. He said, what difference does it make that you could drink milk? I said, if you're digesting that lactase yourself, that's 30% of the energy of milk that you're getting that otherwise you're leaving on the table. So imagine that if this is a big part of your diet, you're talking about 30% more energy to pregnant women who are carrying pregnancies, who are lactating themselves, who can wean their kids off of it. You know, that makes a big difference to survival.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
How, can you go back to the chart?
Sure.
But what actually drives the increase, or you know, the what actually drives the gene towards fixation? I mean, was it because the milk was helping those people survive better? So the people who were lactase persistent, was it part of what made them successful?
That's it. Yeah, absolutely.
Wouldn't that have increased the rate of childbirth? Because you know, now are, you know, you don't have lactational anovulation taking place as much.
That's right. Yeah. When you've got selection, you have two components of selection: survival, reproduction. And either one could increase and have the effect that the allele increases over time. And if we compare two alleles to each other, we can actually, this is a great equation that does this, but I'm not going to show it to you. but you can actually calculate, you know, consider the survival characteristics of this allele, the survival characteristics of that allele. If they're different and reproduction is the same, then they're going to have different intrinsic rates of growth. Consider the reproductive characteristics of this allele, the reproductive characteristics of that allele. Now, it could be that both of them balance each other, that the gene that makes you survive more will also make you reproduce less, in which case they would be, you know, neutral to each other. It wouldn't increase. But usually they're not exactly the same, and one of them increases and the other one decreases. In the case of lactase, this is one of the really interesting things about recent human evolution, because in Germany today, say 80% of copies of this gene are the lactase persistence version. That's a version that existed in one copy somewhere around 8,000 years ago. So that's gone from one up to something like 100 million. Because there's, what, 140 million copies of a gene in Germany, 70 million people. Okay, that's gone from 1 to 100 million. But the bad version of this gene, the one that's been declining in frequency, has gone from the Neolithic population size, which was, you know, maybe a million people in Germany or less, up to today being 20% of a German population of 70 million. Now, it's increased. Both versions of the gene have increased in numbers, but what's happened is that one of them's increased a lot more. And we see the signs of that increase because this new version carried a lot of stuff with it. It hitchhiked, whereas the old version, it hasn't been hitchhiking. It's been increasing, but it doesn't carry a lot of things with it. It carries the same stuff it had before.
How is the point of origin pegged at 8,000 years ago?
That's on the basis of the distance across the genome that we see this uniformity. So we know what the rate of shuffling is, the rate of recombination. We can say that given this distance, how long ago could this mutation have happened and still be uniform over this distance?
Isn't that what they call genetic clocks or something like that? Or?
In this case, it's what we call a... There's really a name for it. A molecular clock. Molecular clock is usually you're comparing two species. In this case, we're not. In this case, we're looking at recombination. So I actually don't think that we've come up with a name for that.
Couldn't it be that 8,000 years ago? I mean, that sounds like a coincidence. Wasn't that right around the time the Garden of Eden was?
So, let me flip forward. Actually, this is a great occasion for this.
Oh, I just gave away my creationist leanings.
Your secret agenda.
Because if we look at the times, it turns out that there's a whole lot of genes like this. This is a chart that's showing a histogram. These are counts in 10 generation intervals by our estimate of how old they are of genes that have some sort of selection that's happened recently in Europeans, that's the blue, and in Africans, that's the red. And you can see that the patterns are slightly different, but what both of them share is that the maximum time of these things is something like in Europe 5,500 and in Africa 8,000 years ago. So we want to talk about biblical time scales. Here's the biblical time scale, right? Except in this case, why is it on that time scale? It's on this time scale because this is the time period at which the population growth was high and the rate of environmental change was also high. When we look for selection, we're looking for two things. We're looking for populations that don't match their environment well, so their ecology has changed. And we're looking for populations that have a lot of numbers, because numbers give more opportunities for new mutations. And this is not an individual-wise number. I mean, the mutation rate is the same across all these individuals at all these times, but you've got more individuals later in time. I worked out, let's see, this theoretical prediction of what it should look like based on population growth. That's what was behind this number. And what we predicted was that we'd see more change as we came up closer to the present, except that there's a limit to our ability to see things. Once we get up to very recent things, they haven't become very common. So we can't see them anymore. They haven't gotten up to high enough numbers. It's like that lactase thing. If it's right after it originates, it hasn't gotten up to be common yet. We can't see it. So we can see things that have happened a while ago that have had time to get common. I said, this is what we ought to see. Not very much very recently, because we can't see it. A lot a little before that, because that's when the population is large enough to make a difference. And not very much a long time ago, because the population was small. And that's basically what we found. I was really excited by this.
I understand. Mm-hmm. What does that huge dip represent, where it just starts going way down?
Why does it go way down as we get up to the present? Basically, if you have a mutation here that makes you have 50% more kids, but it happened only 1,000 years ago, it still hasn't gotten up to be very common. It takes a really exceptional thing to get to be that common. 50% is, imagine, making you have 3 kids instead of 2, that's really strong. For lactase, we expect that this is about a 10% advantage, which maybe you had 10 kids instead of 9. That's pretty high. But for something that makes you have 2 kids instead of 1, or 4 kids instead of 1, or 10 kids instead of 1, they don't happen often.
So is that point from where it starts dropping, is that a big population? Is that population
the population?
The data isn't established enough.
There haven't been enough generations since that happened.
Yeah, exactly. The population chart goes something like this, where in the Neolithic we have a lot of growth around the age that farming's invented. It grows, and it continues to grow exponentially, of course, up to the present. So 6 billion people now. 100 years ago, there's something like, 1.5 billion people? It's a lot less. Something like 1,000 years ago, there were maybe 100 million people. So the population has exploded. But in that exploding population, a gene would have to be incredibly strong for it to become common enough for us to see it. I expect, actually, that a lot of things happened, and we'll see them, when we are able to sequence more people. So we'll see the things that have only gotten up to 1%, things that should not be there if there wasn't some advantage to them. 1% of a billion is a big number. But that we can't see now because the proportion isn't high enough yet. All right, I was really excited by this. I do want to point out that Darwin predicted this. It's one of those things where you think you're really excited, and you go out and you test your theory, and it confirms with your predictions, and then you see, well, yeah, but old Darwin, he knew already. Variations manifestly useful or pleasing to man appear only occasionally. The chance of their appearance will be much increased by a large number of individuals being kept. So he says numbers the highest importance. For Darwin, this is all about pigeons. is breeding these pigeons, and they like, you go to the state fair and see pigeons, they all have feathers on their feet and strange crests and weird color patterns. If you want to have those strange variations, you're going to have to look at a lot of pigeons before you see them. And that's Darwin's point. If you want to select for something that's unique, you have to look at a lot of individuals. It's the same thing for humans. If you want to change humans' ecology and expect to have some sort of response to it, you have to have a lot of individuals to select from. So just to get down to where we are, this chart actually shows better than a description. If we talk about the last 40,000 years in time, in terms of our comparison to chimpanzees, our ancestor from chimps, 6 million years ago, there's 6 million years on our lineage, 6 million on theirs, and 40,000 years in our evolution is a small fraction of that time. But if we look in terms of mutations that did something for us, mutations that had some selective advantage, it's a very large fraction that we can observe that have happened in the last 40,000 years. The distance between us and chimpanzees in terms of adaptive mutations, things that were fixed by selection, is on the order of 40,000. We're seeing on the order of 5,000 or 6,000 that look like they've happened very recently. And that's huge. It's just huge compared to what's there.
Do you know what the number is, the percentage for increase?
So if I was to say, how much faster is our evolution going more recently?
Yeah.
My best estimate is 100 times faster. It corresponds directly with there being 100 times more people. There's magic going on. It's just that the more people there are, the more chances that there are for change. And the other thing is what has changed in our ecology. If we look at categories of stuff that have changed, the biggest category really is this pathogen-host interaction, the stuff that resists disease in one way or another. There's something like 24 mutations that resist malaria. Many of the big polymorphisms that separate human populations, the Duffy blood type, for instance, is there because of malaria. Duffy is 95% in West Africans and 1% in Europe. It's a huge difference between populations. Why is it there? It's there because Duffy gives you resistance to Vivax malaria. That's all it is. Skin pigmentation are some of these things, but there aren't so many of those. There's a couple dozen. But we also find, interestingly, we don't know what all the genes do, but we find that there are genes that are involved in stuff that's sort of interesting, like neuronal function. I'll point out neurotransmitter receptors are one thing that's been changing a lot. If I had to guess, it could be different things in different places. But if I had to guess, I'd say this has to do with something about society, something about living in big groups maybe, that selects for different components of mood or different personality or something, you know, a little different. Okay, so what do I have to finish off? Yeah, I have examples, but I think that's a good place to stop. If we wanted to look at another species that had this kind of rapid evolution going on, this is Teosinte, the wild ancestor of corn, and this is a domesticated but not hybrid version of corn. This is a big morphological difference, which they believe in corn was caused initially by a few genes. But if we look at the corn genome and say how much of it is under selection recently because of humans selecting for things, you get the same fraction as we are looking at in humans. So we're imposing selection on each other, if you like, that's as strong as, and affects as many things as, we're imposing on domesticates. Does it mean we're domesticating ourselves? Not really. Maybe in some respects. But what it means is that our ecology has changed that much just since becoming modern humans. This isn't like Neanderthals in us. This is early modern humans in us, in genetic terms. And so it's maybe my task and that of many other people to figure out what this means in behavioral morphological terms. Lots of corn. That's what did it. It's lots of corn. Okay.
So in this year of Darwin, I've heard some like recorded lectures and so forth, and there are some people out there who seem to have pretty good, you know, reputation as scientists who argue that humans are not evolving mm-hmm. any longer.
Mm-hmm.
And you seem to make a case that at least from a genetic standpoint, this is a slam dunk. I mean, there's no interpreting the vagaries here. It's pretty clear that there have been significant changes over the last 5 to 8 to 40,000 years or whatever. I can't remember the names of any of the
mm-hmm.
papers.
Mm-hmm.
But what's the other side to this that other people will be arguing that it's not happening?
Well, some people will want to talk about what's happening in the last 100 years, right? So let's take the last 100 years of history, and now, you know, people are living easier lives. They're not dying as much. If you imagine what are the differences in survival that are going to create differences in gene frequencies, they've reduced. I still look at that and say, but we still have differences in fertility. And to the extent that there's any genes that are connected with fertility, there could still be changes in humans. But I think part of it is a prospective approach. Look to the future, what's going to happen? And people say, look, you know, we don't vary that much anymore in whether we live or die. Yeah.
In terms of variation, I'm reminded of an article which appeared, I think, in Newsweek a few months back. It was an article on a two-headed girl.
Uh-huh.
And to me, this strikes me as being just a perfect example of, you know, because we've got billions of people now, the possibilities of different genetic changes is radically increased, and
mm-hmm.
even to the extent of making a two-headed girl.
Oh, yeah. P.T. Barnum brought together people who had genetic variations. They weren't all genetic. I mean, some of them are phenotypic variations that are results of environment or teratogens or something like that, but P.T. Barnum brought together all these people. If you didn't have them together in one place, you wouldn't realize how many of them there are. But evolution, one of the biggest things that it does is it takes stuff that's initially rare and makes some of it common so that 10,000, 15,000 years later, suddenly the population's transformed. I tell my students that, look, 8,000 years ago, nobody could digest milk at your age. And it's stunning, you know, to think that this has gone in the European population from literally zero up to a really high fraction. And at the same time, in some other populations, a parallel process has happened. And in other populations, it hasn't happened at all. But, I mean, the other aspect of this is that when you look at cave art, you say, those people are like us. Whatever it is that makes us human, that we share as humans, is something that has to be at least that old. And from the standpoint of comparing human populations, you know, native Australians and native Europeans and native South Africans, you know, people who've lived in those places and originated there, those people do not share ancestors more recently than 30 or 40,000 years ago. And that means that whatever it is that makes humans around the world human is something that has to be of that age or older. So I think some people will look at that and say, well, we haven't changed because we're still humans. And we couldn't have changed very much. I would tend to say that what that means is that human is something that you have to make a lot more inclusive than maybe you thought, you know, because it has to encompass all of these changes that have happened since that time. Yeah?
You were showing earlier that cranial capacity is seem to be getting smaller.
Oh, yeah.
What do you think about the hypothesis that with the rise of cesarean sections that
mm-hmm.
will cranial capacity will grow?
Well, let's ask, why are our heads shrinking? Or why have they been shrinking? I do have to be careful. I don't know what will happen in the future. Why have they been shrinking? Yeah.
Well, one theory could be that there's a selective process of who's, you know, of choosing mates
mm-hmm.
who have wider or narrower hips and,
mm-hmm.
and cultural stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
which could change
birth canals and...
Could be,
Also, we, as she pointed out, you know, we not only have cesarean sections, we have, well, the chances of dying in childbirth, except in this lousy country, have gone down.
Yeah.
So,
absolutely.
So there must have been a selection against large craniums.
Okay, so childbirth. Yeah, childbirth is the focus of selection. Yeah,
big
absolutely.
Factor.
Idea?
Well, I was just going to say that bone structure in women, as their hips get smaller, they're able to move, have less movement disorders and biomechanical disorders.
So continued selection on bipedality and efficiency there too. Selects for narrower hips, and narrower hips select for smaller infant heads. And I should add that in these early Neolithic cemeteries, when we talk about who do we find buried at that time, it's mostly kids. You know, so when we say, what is this selection? What is happening here? One of the big things that's happening is kids are dying. And kids are dying of disease. They're dying of malnutrition. They're dying of all kinds of things, but why not? Yeah, they're dying of incompatibilities between pelvis and heads. And so smaller infant heads make sense. Well, I got to tell you, there's a simpler hypothesis. We're getting stupider. It does account for the data. And I ask my students, well, you know, why would your heads get smaller? Well, maybe we don't need them anymore. And
is there
some
correlation, though, between size and intelligence capacity?
40%. 40%. 40% of the variation's IQ is explained by head size within sexes.
Mm-hmm. But isn't it?
But also the amount of gyra of the brain, how folded the brain is.
Absolutely.
That's also a component.
Yeah, yeah.
But by that standard, whales and dolphins should be geniuses.
Well,
because they have a lot more.
How would you measure that?
They are, but they're so smart, they're not letting on. I know this because
that's
rule of fishing.
Yeah, but when the dolphins leave you,
that's right.
You see why? When I started, I'm talking about brain size and tooth size and all these phenotypes. I say, well, we have a problem with these, with the genes. One of the real conveniences of genes is that they're digital. But when we have a genotype, or we have a haplotype, which is a series of genotypes, we know that it's the same thing. And we can calculate the probability that it would be two different things that actually looked the same. With your head size, or the cranial index, or your tooth size, or anything else like that, we immediately have an environmental component that is, from our perspective, uncontrolled. Now, why did the head shrink? The first thing we've got to do is get rid of nutrition as a hypothesis. And in the case of head size, I'm very confident that it's not nutrition because of the pace of change. Change fast. But it's still the first hypothesis you would have. The second hypothesis you go to, if it's not a direct consequence of environment, the second thing you go to is that there's selection. But if there's selection, what's the cause? Now, selection is a hypothesis about rate. The test of selection is a hypothesis about rate. But the test of the cause of selection, now it's about all kinds of other stuff. It's about the relationship between head size and causes of mortality. We know that big heads are bad because they use a lot of energy and they take a long time to develop. So if you ask me, why would heads get smaller? The first thing I would go to is, if you didn't have to wait to have the head the size it is when you're an adult, if you could mature a little bit faster, that would make more difference than anything else. If you were protein limited, if you couldn't grow a big brain because you had a low protein diet, as early cereal agriculturalists had, then you'd want to have a smaller brain. If you were energy limited, if you're going through famines, and you have to support, and that brain is like a 20-watt light bulb on top of your head all the time. You can just turn it off. So there's lots of reasons why it might get smaller. But if we ask which of the reasons was the most important for these people, that's a hard thing to test scientifically. That's, you know, yeah.
Is it just newborn babies' head sizes that are smaller, or is it adults?
It's grown-ups, adults. And in fact, in the case of newborns, we really don't know. Yeah.
So when you look at individual brain regions like cerebral cortex and stuff, are they all shrinking, or is one part getting bigger while the rest are shrinking?
Well, here's a hint. The cranial index changed. So not only were they shrinking, they're also changing in shape.
Mm-hmm.
Since Neanderthals, I'll say beyond that, from the standpoint of particular components of the brain, we don't know. But I'll say that since Neanderthals, our neocortex has shrunk compared to our cerebellum. So the shrinking is, you know, forebrain as opposed to midbrain. But that's as much as we know. Yeah.
So then what's the hypothesis about why Neanderthals got such big brains?
Why did Neanderthals have big brains? Let's see. The really interesting aspect of that graph of brain size is how slow it is. If you wanted to select for a trait, if you wanted to make your horses bigger, it doesn't take very long. You know, selection can make this happen like this. You know, 5 or 6 generations, and you could really substantially increase. If we talk about 50 generations, you could double their size. This is really slow. If we calculate out what's the per generation amount of change in brain size, well, if we're going from 600 cc's 2 million years ago up to, well, let's talk to females, 600 to 1200, that's easy. So we're going to go upwards 600 cc's in 2 million years. That's 100,000 generations, give or take. So you're talking about something like 3 or 4 1,000ths of a cc per generation. It's not very much. It's so little that you can't measure the difference in that sense. So then you say, why is it so slow?
Would that imply that it's just not that important of a change?
One possibility is, if we're going to use rate as a test, what we'd say is that this is indistinguishable from genetic drift. That's one way of saying that it's unimportant or it's neutral. I don't think that that's true, because if we imagined brains, it would always have been better to be smaller. We know that that force is there. So we have to posit a countervailing force that's holding things up, and over time, the balance between these forces has changed. The countervailing force has got to be function. But now if we ask, why is it that they change so slowly in their relation over time, we've got at least two hypotheses. One is that change was inherently difficult. It was hard to find mutations that paid for themselves in exerting more cost by making a bigger brain, but having function that paid for it. That's one hypothesis. Another hypothesis is that this process was sort of a random walk influenced hypothesis, where one direction of change happened to be biased because it was getting better function over time, but the selection at no single time was ever very strong. We don't have a test of that right now. That's what I can say. Yeah.
But if we're really talking about the functionality, mm-hmm. you're talking about a whole suite of different genetic characteristics that are working together as far as, well, intelligence as an example of functionality of the brain and what that represents. Wouldn't that whole suite, wouldn't it be more difficult to get them all firing on the same level in an adaptive sense over time, as opposed to a single trait thing being adaptive?
Yeah. If you ask me to stop playing devil's advocate for a minute and say what I really think, what I really think is that the brain is inherently difficult to build, mm-hmm. and it's hard to get mutations that optimize it. And that's an intrinsically rare thing, to find a mutation that makes a brain work better. And working means not only that it has to have some functional qualities, you know, it talks better, it imagines space better, it thinks of new ideas better, but also that it uses less energy. Optimization is a difficult thing for evolution to do. And so if you ask me, why does this take a long time for our brains to get bigger, it's because those changes are rare. And if you ask me, why does it suddenly start to reduce in size when our population gets big, I say, because the good things are happening more often. Hmm. So over the course of history, prehistory, you had mutations, some of which actually made the brain smaller and work better, others of which made it bigger and work better, and that the balance between those slightly shifted over time because the functional requirements of human brains have shifted. But in the last 10,000 years, we've got a lot of making up for lost time in terms of making things work more efficiently. Now, that's a really hopeful hypothesis, because it's saying that we didn't get dumber. What actually happened was that we've gotten more efficient. Yeah.
There are two ideas here. One is that you said 40% correlation, but correlation doesn't mean cause.
That's right.
So
that's right.
It may be that while there's a correlation that says, you know, that that's the relationship of intelligence to brain size, that doesn't necessarily mean that those two are related. It could be some other factor.
It's really strong positive evidence that they're not causally related.
Yeah,
from a genetic point of view.
And the other thing is, at the maximum of head size there, you showed the graph and the met, but you didn't show us a head. Does anybody in the room have a head that is of that size? I imagine that there's a certain...
Oh, my head's around 1,800 cc's. Yeah, my head's bigger than average for a Cro-Magnon head.
Okay, so would it be as big as the large, you know, at the top end of that compared to...
Oh, yeah. If we talk about the variation in brain size, the variation in human endocranial volume is on the order of the standard deviations on the order of 100 cc's.
So we're saying that the average has gone up and then come back down, but the variation hasn't changed. I mean, it can only get so small or so large, and we're out of the ballpark.
Yeah.
So really, it may not really reflect very much of anything.
If we shrank another 150 cubic centimeters, we'd be Homo erectus sized.
Yeah.
So it is a big change. It's a standard deviation and a half. It's a big change.
Okay.
But if we talk about...
Like between you and me.
Yeah, between us and the Neolithic.
Oh.
We've really reduced a lot. But the difference between individuals is quite high. The difference between sexes is also high. And sexes, I was careful to say, within sex, there's this relationship of brain size and IQ. It's not true between sexes.
Also, the relationship between brain size and IQ, you have to factor out age, because...
Shrinks with age,
Well, what shrinks with age?
Your brain.
Well, your skull size doesn't. And
case
and
in point, Henry.
Children. No, I'm just saying that children, you know, are not as intelligent as, you know, adolescents. Well, who knows?
Brain size and brain size is so interesting because it's a compilation of so many things, so many functional things. So it's sort of like stature. You say stature, how tall you are. What difference does it make how tall you are to your survival? It makes a difference how long your legs are relative to your mass. It makes a difference whether you've got enough room for your digestive system. It makes every little part of it makes a difference. And at the outset, maybe stature itself makes a difference because taller people have more offspring for whatever reason, socially respected or whatever. You could imagine that is true. It is a little bit true. But then you say, how do these components all combine to make a fitness value associated with a stature? Brain size is, if anything, worse from our perspective because it's got more stuff in it. And the fact that we have a correlation between brain size and some functional thing, IQ, whatever it is such strong evidence that it hasn't been selected. Because if we were selecting for IQ, the variation, the co-variation between that and brain size should be gone. Yeah.
Well, couldn't there be from the Neolithic on, we've basically been starving ourselves of the rich, organic diet that our ancestors had before that.
Yeah.
Limited amount of, you know, food types compared to a very wide-ranging variety of food types. I would argue probably we're eating a lot less of a lot of these organisms, a lot of these animals. We're not eating brains as much as people probably did in the Neolithic. Well, they need to eat every part of the animal that you get, right? So we're no longer having this rich ingredient mix going in that we can select components from for building. It might have been a luxury to have these big brains because they had a rich dietary environment in order to have a lot of material. So yeah, let the brain go big. Right,
but I'll say that the other side of this is that we have tremendous social buffering influencing our survival now. And if you want to find out something, whereas 50,000 years ago you had to know yourself, today you can ask somebody. And maybe it's that we just didn't need to retain that kind of information as much anymore. I mean, it could be my freshmen are right. We just don't need it.
You've actually hit on exactly what my question was. How does the timing, because I don't know what the historical timing is, the timing of the beginning of the decrease in brain size correlate to specialization within cultures?
The decrease appears to kick in around Neolithic times, in Europe a little earlier, Mesolithic times. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about the last 10,000 years. There is specialization in Upper Paleolithic societies. And for that matter, in hunter-gatherer societies where we have sedentary hunter-gatherers. But I have to expect that this would have been more so with the invention of agriculture and real sedentism, where people are living in villages and having different roles. So I would say in that the answer to your question is that it's around the same time.
I remember a professor relating a translation of a cuneiform text from some priest in Samaria, who was bemoaning the dissemination of writing out to the general population as opposed to being kept with just the priestly elite, because he was worried that it was going to destroy people's memories.
Yeah.
That was Plato.
Yeah.
It goes before that.
Okay.
This was cuneiform. Same idea, though.
Same idea.
Plato said that too, huh?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Probably has been repeated by others as well.
Well, and
they read it somewhere.
A lot of people are saying the same thing. It's a generational issue within our own within our own society that people are saying the same thing about the internet, that the internet is destroying the brains of younger people, and I'm one of those younger people who's infuriated by that argument because I think it's the same thing, that the internet is not making us stupider, it's just changing our society the same way that writing does.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm a software developer. I can't add and subtract. Seriously. I look at numbers and they don't make any sense to me, so I get on a calculator, but I can write some pretty elaborate software systems. I just don't do it anymore.
Yeah.
Well, I'll do your accounting. You can write my programs.
Let's talk afterwards. Because I had to call and get an extension this year.
I see. No, I'm just starting. I can't do it.
Actually, I got one more question.
Sure.
I don't mean to get personal, but I'm really curious how you actually know your cranial capacity.
It's not so hard to do a regression if you know your width and length. You know, it'll give you an estimate within a couple percent.
It's the geometry that you just said you can do.
Yeah. That's one of those things about myself. I just don't want to know.
I'll tell you, I have my freshmen fill out a questionnaire the first week of their labs, and I have for several years now been showing them the heritability of stature in my classes based on what they will report as their parents' stature and their own. And we get good estimates that way. I've been doing head circumference for a couple of years. And the only thing that I've used this for so far is the relation of head circumference in them versus their weight as babies, as self-reported. Mm-hmm. So it turns out they correlate hardly at all. And this is because most of the variation in birth size now is gestational age. Mm-hmm. So kids are born at 40 weeks versus 41 versus 37. That makes so much variation that it outweighs everything in terms of their genetics. That's a nice thing to illustrate. But we could start telling them about their cranial capacities, I suppose.
You find out their cranial capacity and compare it to the grades people got in the previous semester.
That, I think, is where the college would step in.
Actually, you know what? You could save yourself a lot of work, and you measure their cranial capacity at the beginning of the term and assign them a grade based on that.
We'll get another class.
Actually, yeah.
Well, it's 4 o'clock. Right. Dr. Hawks, very enjoyable. Thank you very
Great.
Much.